Hello there. My name is Andrew Sweeney, and I'd like to introduce a new series of video essays based on my summer reading of a 700-page spiritual classic entitled Meditations on the Tarot, A Journey into Christian Hermeticism by the anonymous author who everybody knows was Valentine Tomberg. This is not a summary of Tomberg's work per se, but rather my own idiosyncratic readings of the tarot, partly inspired by Tomberg's work. This series aims to explore tarot symbolism and is a contemplation of the meanings of the main archetypes presented in the tarot card deck. As a longtime practitioner of Tantric Buddhism, an intensely symbolic and, dare I say, magical path, I'm on a journey to understand the symbolism of Western esoteric systems. Tarot and Tomberg's book seemed like a fun place to start. The tarot, the origin of the playing cards as we know them, constitutes a series of what are called arcanum, which means mysteries or secrets. In most tarot decks, there are 22 major and 56 minor arcana. Here I will follow Tomberg and examine the major arcanum exclusively. But unlike Tomberg, whose source is the original Marseille Tarot, I will use the more popular and accessible Rider-Waite's version, created by Golden Dawn esoterist A.E. Waite and illustrated by Pamela Coleman Smith in the early 20th century. In the past, human beings had a closer relationship to symbols and dream language. But today, the modern human being is in many ways symbolically illiterate. We have stopped listening to our dreams, and yet we are possessed by political dreams and ideologies, perhaps as a substitute for a more primordial mode of being. The noise and complexity of our media, our pseudo-rationalism and binary thinking, our scientism and materialist reductionism make us blind to great movements of myth and meaning. With some practice and study, however, we can intuit what a color, a cup, a star, a crown, or a triangle signify within a certain visual context. We can learn a basic visual alphabet and begin to understand the primary symbols which animate our society. Symbols are like compressed information files. They give us access to a complex and embodied world beyond the banal. They are heuristic rather than algorithmic. In other words, they provide a poetic gestalt rather than an instruction manual. Today, in the information age, people are rediscovering magic and religious metaphor for good or ill. The interconnected global village brings us back to the world of resonant symbolic immersion and participation mystique. As Marshall McLuhan pointed out, in the new media landscape, we privilege sensory gestalt to literary understanding. In the age of the internet, even if we don't believe in magic, we are bound up in a dense array of magic technology and media with its intensified hypnotic messages. Tarot gives us a glimpse into an enchanted and embodied world that we seem to have lost. It appeals to our transpersonal and transrational sensibilities with its ancient Egyptian and medieval Hebrew Christian imagery. The tarot arcana have a dreamlike quality that feels alien but familiar, like a native language that we have forgotten. As Carl Jung has pointed out, collective dream images are unfiltered descriptions of being. Studying them is a way of deciphering raw psychic energy and its movements. This frees us from our linear narratives and prosaic or logocentric mind prisons. In the early 20th century, psychoanalysts brought back myth and symbolism to show us that progress towards a rational enlightenment is in itself a myth. Human beings will never become rational machines run by algorithms. There will always be a glitch in the matrix, a crack in everything, to quote Leonard Cohen. We will continue to fall in love, make war, be feverishly possessed by the power of the emperor, the wisdom of the hermit, and the passion of the lover. Our fate is subject to the collective forces that the tarot system represents. We can be conscious of this fact or not. We can become active agents in our dreams or remain ciphers lost in the matrix. The choice is ours. Tarot is for intuitive or poetically oriented people. It is not for cynical realists or disembodied analytical philosophers. The mark of an authentic symbol system like the tarot is its poetic force and the fact that it endures. Tarot symbols are powerful because of their subtlety and rawness. Tarot gives us insight, deepens our intuitive understanding, and provokes questions. It does not tell us how to behave or offer moral recipes. At best, it trains us in a fluid and intelligent view of reality. At worst, it encourages New Age psychobabble. Tarot is best thought of as a resource for contemplation, leading to a deepening of the mysteries rather than an expression of any dogmatic system. Some people use the tarot to predict the future, manifest financial success, obtain self-mastery, or try to fulfill their egoic desires. Of course, that is the pop culture version of the tarot, which may have a place. However, my aim here is to follow Tomberg and explore the depth of tarot symbolism in our own time and place. This will require a love of elaboration and fantasy rather than dull realism, a gift for exploring the liminal twilight realms and entering the dream space between life and death. So now I will read a commentary on tarot number one, The Magician. The first arcana contains the essence of the entire tarot deck, which is a magician's journey. But what exactly is magic, and what does the magician do? It is worth pointing out that the magician follows the fool, who is numbered zero in most tarot decks. In other words, you can't be a magician unless you have first dared to be a fool. As Samuel Beckett put it, the magician needs to learn to fail harder or become more comfortable with a certain kind of creative chaos. Only the ass, the idiot, the true failure becomes a great magician. And novel creative acts occur only after much trial and error and the exhaustion of ego strategy. And only the one who is first a fool will venture far enough into the unknown to discover the artistry of real magic. Half of the magician's job is the creation of enchantment and wonder. The other side is destroying or transforming our unconscious slavery to mechanical forces. We create magic to connect to what is most alive, but also as a homeopathic remedy against mechanicalness and inadvertedness. Magic is paradoxically the open secret of all reality. Magicians show us the always already existing state. Magic is a remedy to the fact that our perceptions have been dulled by repetition and suffering, that we have forgotten the magic a child knows in every moment. Everything from flowers to skyscrapers, from the human voice to the form of a snail, is magic in a child's world. The magician helps us to return to that state of original terror and wonder. Furthermore, all activities, from the most mundane to the most spectacular, have their magicians. One could be a magician in the realm of music, mathematics, or conversation, not to mention finance or plumbing. Any activity with a spirit of excellence that appears impossible and effortless to others is magic. And each person can potentially create their own unique form of magic through artful participation and intense dedication to the muse. The magician reminds us of the vast expanse of possibility, which is the meaning of the infinity symbol above his head. He points to the ground, reminiscent of the Buddha who declared, "The earth is my witness." He also raises his staff to the sky. These gestures embodied the hermetic principle of correspondence, as above, so below. However, ultimately, above and below are also magical illusions. The sky only seems to be above us, where it is actually all around us, nowhere and everywhere at the same time. Things might appear as fixed hierarchies of meaning, but they can be magically turned on their head. The magician's game is a play of dynamic and shifting perspectives. The magician works with the four elements, which are placed on his working table, symbolized by the pentacle, cup, sword, and wand. These are associated with the primary elements, earth, water, fire, and space. The magician's work is to combine and transform these primary materials into a living expression. He therefore doesn't need to exploit resources or go anywhere special. He has everything on his table right in front of him. The magician aims for what Tomberg calls concentration without effort, which today we would call a flow state. Magic flows when our work becomes spontaneous rather than strained and artificial. However, it takes much work to be effortless. As William Blake puts it, to create a little flower is a labor of ages. Magic is a labor of love rather than just a duty. It is serious play and vocation instead of a 9-to-5 job. Of course, magic is full of danger. For instance, a gift for magic might be passed down to an unworthy heir or someone with no talent or integrity. One could become screwed up by the weight of inherited power, like the child of a billionaire. Magic could become a heavy burden, like Frodo's ring, and drain one's life energy. The tantric tradition talks about the black magician, Rudra, whose power becomes destructive, like a drunken elephant. Without the proper preparation and humility, magic fails. If one is driven by a monomania, the magician could become a mad scientist and create Frankenstein's monster. Black magic is about obsession, addiction, and shortcuts to bliss. It is the creation of special effects to replace natural creativity. For example, artists often get addicted to pleasing the audience and lose their creative edge. They become caricatures of their own creations. Their magic show becomes an eternal repetition of the same, rather than a unique and memorable event like a rock concert performed by geriatrics. Contrary to what we think, magic is not an impressive demonstration of technique or pyrotechnics. Instead, it demonstrates how things really are. A good magician doesn't just create magic, he removes the veils. Much of his job is subtraction rather than addiction. However, he adds his unique quality to the world. Contrary to what we think, magic is a humble task. A sense of specialness is one of its main obstacles. The best magic is not cheap hypnotism or pop entertainment, but actual revelation. True magic always has a quality of originality or freshness. While imitation may be necessary for beginners, the transcendence we call magic happens when special effects are discarded. The great film director Federico Fellini created film magic, not through technical wizardry or special effects, but striking bold images, such as a white bull coming out of the fog, or big flakes of snow falling on a seaside town in Sicily. Again, magic requires the foolish freedom of experiment and an intense sense of presence. The message of the magician's card is, in a nutshell, clear your table, lay out your essential tools, and begin to take your metaphorical rabbit out of the hat. So with a humble, dedicated, and childlike, but not childish intensity, we can begin our investigation of the magic of the tarot. So I will now read a commentary on the second tarot card called the High Priestess. The second arcana, the High Priestess, follows the magician in the tarot. According to Valentine Tomberg, she represents a stage of spiritual growth called gnosis. While the magician creates magic, the High Priestess offers method, wisdom, and gnosis, or sacred knowledge. The High Priestess sits cross-legged on a chair with a Torah and a cross. The cross represents the unity of the vertical and horizontal realms, or spiritual depth and worldly action. Tomberg links her to Sophia, the feminine aspect of the divine and the personification of wisdom. Therefore, she represents philosophy, since Philo Sophia literally means to love the goddess of wisdom. The full moon on the High Priestess's crown represents this wisdom. The crescent moon at her feet symbolizes fertility and growth. Like the moon that moves the tides invisibly, the High Priestess has a magnetic and intellectual power to reflect knowledge. However, Her knowledge is not merely intellectual. While she sits on a formal throne and wears a scholarly tiara, she is flanked by pomegranates and palm leaves, symbolizing the erotic fruits of the feminine and masculine. Again, the High Priestess's gnosis is not cold and abstract, but fully sensual, like a harvest moon. We can compare the High Priestess to the magician in the same way we can compare the philosopher to the poet. The magician or poet has the energy of youth. The High Priestess or philosopher has enduring wisdom. The magician acts in the now. The High Priestess is patient and ripens her wisdom over time. While the magician gives us mystery, the High Priestess gives us meaning. She makes order out of chaos. He creates a certain theater of creative chaos. She works through meditation and contemplation. He gives theatrical performances and does dangerous experiments. The magician keeps his process hidden. The High Priestess gives us explicit method. Magic and gnosis play a dangerous, interconnected game. Rock stars, painters, and poets so often die young, paving the ground for new artistic movements with their blood. Think Arthur Rimbaud and Vincent van Gogh. Philosophers like Martin Heidegger and Friedrich Nietzsche made serious errors before 40, while other postmodern philosophers got lost in academic jargon. This points to the fact that the magician and the High Priestess need each other to shine, as good poetry needs philosophical content and good philosophy needs a certain aesthetic. In the tarot, gender cliches are often reversed. There is, for instance, a female pope, which we will discuss later. The High Priestess stands in front of two pillars of the Temple of Solomon, signifying that she is a person of political power. She holds the symbolic order while the magician dances with chaos, the opposite of the explicit symbolism that equates women with chaos and men with order. However, this inversion makes perfect symbolic sense when we consider the yin-yang symbol with its white dot in a black space and black dot in a white space. We can also consider Carl Jung's anima, the hidden female spirit of the male, and animus, the hidden masculine spirit of the female. In other words, the feminine has a nucleus of power and intellect, the masculine, a nucleus of chaos and mystery. To put it more simply, the core of a woman is a man, and the core of a man is a woman. Tarot is arcane again and points to the inner secret world, not the explicit, obvious one. The High Priestess's knowledge and initiation are not about detached intellectual understanding, but embodiment and incarnation. This is why Thomberg says she gives us the gift of tears and compassionately connects us with the rest of humanity. We cannot approach the High Priestess with dry eyes, Thomberg tells us. Platitudes and abstraction do not function in her realm. The High Priestess's wisdom is not solemn or sanctimonious either, which is why she is surrounded by fruit and the tree of life. While carrying the Torah, she adds ruach, a beautiful Hebrew word for spirit or breath. She adds ruach to the law. Incidentally, in the Jewish tradition, the Holy Spirit is feminine. The High Priestess is therefore the knowledge of the Holy Spirit. I will now read tarot card number 3, the Empress. We can say that Hermetic philosophy tends towards the inner, the mysterious, and the hidden. In other words, the feminine principle. The tarot is full of nuanced female archetypes. While Christianity focuses on the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, Thomberg's Hermetic Christianity adds the Mother, Daughter, and Holy Soul. The esoteric traditions always give equal or more symbolic weight to the feminine. The Empress is equal or perhaps even more powerful than the Emperor, in other words. How does she differ from the High Priestess as a feminine archetype? While the High Priestess represents the lunar realm, the Empress represents the solar. There is a summer fullness to her in contrast to the chastity of the High Priestess. She rules over nature rather than culture. She is the elemental force that makes the wheat grow, ensures the forests and streams are plentiful, and she bestows peace and prosperity in the empire. An empress is more significant than a queen or priestess because she lords over a collection of principalities. She is therefore neither provincial nor national. She is a universal monarch. Tomberg would say that she represents the inner world of sacred magic. But what is the difference between her sacred magic and that of the magician? Her magic occurs from overflowing fullness rather than talent or drive or a lack. In other words, the Empress's sacred magic is not constructed. It is fully present in the fluidity and natural synchronicity of the world and its cycles. Unlike the magician, the Empress does not need self-conscious art or culture. Her staff with a globe is a sign of completeness, unlike the magician who is still on a map-making quest. We could say that the Empress rules over the elements and the natural world, whereas the Emperor rules over the aggregates or the culturally constructed aspects of humanity. In Buddhism, the masculine principle is the aggregate, a combination of elements, whereas the feminine principle is the primary element, representing earth, water, fire, air, and space. An emperor creates order for the city or towns, whereas the empress rules over the more unpredictable world of meadows and forests. The symbol of Venus on the empress's shield indicates that she protects and blesses love and marriage and is the fruitful mother of an earthly paradise. The empress is the overflowing, abundant excess of solar life, which gives birth to the physical world. She represents the birth principle, and in some versions of the tarot, she is even pregnant. If the priestess is virginal and scholarly, powerful, and even erotic because of her aestheticism, the empress represents the fullness of marriage, prosperity, birth, and life in bloom. The empress's crown is a 12-star zodiac, signifying the 12 months of the year. Her phallic staff supports the feminine sphere, indicating her completeness again. The pomegranates on her gown are associated with Persephone and Sibyl and symbolize the whole life-death cycle. She is the empress of cycles, seasonal festivals, and the eternal return of life and death. While the emperor imposes top-down law and order and keeps the human world in check through war and peace, the empress rules from the belly, from the interior, from the earth. She is at once the giver of life and the devouring mother. While her red throne and cushions symbolize passion and sensuality, they quickly turn into a throne of blood when we destroy her primeval forests and ocean plankton. While the masculine emperor or Napoleon makes war by drawing borders and laying down the law, the empress creates the entire fauna and flora of nature. However, she also brings arbitrary chaos and destruction, plagues and sickness when her majesty is threatened. She is the protectress of the meta-ecology. She is the soul and bounty of the land. Biodiversity is her realm of creation and destruction.